Centralizētais eksāmens angļu valodā – augstākais mācību satura apguves līmenis.
Hello! This is the listening part of your exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1. You have 1 minute to read the task.
So how'd you sleep last night? The answer is never simple for the 70 million or so Americans who suffer from sleep disorders, such as insomnia. Among those struggling to get a good night's sleep is Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson, whose search for answers to his own sleep issues led to some pretty interesting sleep history. His latest article in The Atlantic is called Can Medieval Sleeping Habit Fix America's Insomnia? Derek, welcome, and we want to hear about the medieval part, of course, but first, how'd you sleep last night?
I slept pretty well. I watched some great NFL games, and honestly, I was so exhausted by how exciting that they were that I was ready to fall asleep for seven consecutive hours, which I suppose, as we're about to talk about, is not a historical norm, necessarily.
Yes. So you found a sleep historian who's been writing about this practice for a few decades. It turns out that this kind of sleep pattern, which is a medieval pattern, has been happening all over the world for a long time. Tell us what it is and how long it's been going on.
That's right. So today, most people think about sleep as something you're supposed to get in one big chunk of 6, 7, 8, 9 hours. But for hundreds of years in Europe, according to the historian Roger Eckerge, people slept in two segments. It's thus called segmented sleep. They would fall asleep around nightfall, and then they would wake up in the middle of the night for a bit of an intermission that the French called dormir, for wake sleep. And then after a few hours of working or chatting by the fire, they would go back to sleep for second sleep. And Eckerge found information or found proof of these of this segmented sleep, not only in Europe, but really around the world, which has opened up modern eyes to the fact that before the Industrial Revolution, there was not one sleep, but two. Some people, I think, looking back to pre-industrial Europe, assume, well, if that's how they slept before artificial light, if that's how they slept before the modern workday, well, surely that must be the best way to sleep. But it turns out when you dig a little bit deeper into the story, you realize two things that are really fascinating. Number one, even though pre-industrial Europe seemed to enjoy segmented sleep, we now have some evidence that suggests that hunter-gatherers from around the world actually have slept for hundreds and maybe thousands of years in one phase. Not only that, but there's also been some attempts to try to restore segmented or two or biphasic sleep for modern adults, and they found that people who sleep in two segments don't necessarily sleep better. So what I find so interesting about this is that on the one hand, you have the illumination, so to speak, of this pre-modern history of sleep, segmented sleep, but also you dig deeper and you realize just because that practice is old doesn't necessarily mean that it's better. In fact, any kind the human body seems so flexible when it comes to sleep that just about any single strategy you have, as long as there is a routine behind it, has the possibility of serving as a restful sleep.
So wait a minute. So it doesn't matter if you're getting all the sleep in 1 7-hour dose or a first sleep and a second sleep divided?
That's exactly what I'm saying, is that based on my reading of the evidence and based on my understanding of history, if you're trying to summarize sort of the total research literature of sleep, sleep itself is very, very flexible depending on what you're trying to get out of it. What's most important is that you set up a routine and stick to it as much as possible.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
So how'd you sleep last night? The answer is never simple for the 70 million or so Americans who suffer from sleep disorders, such as insomnia. Among those struggling to get a good night's sleep is Atlantic staff writer Derek Thompson, whose search for answers to his own sleep issues led to some pretty interesting sleep history. His latest article in The Atlantic is called "Can Medieval Sleeping Habit Fix America's Insomnia?" Derek, welcome, and we want to hear about the medieval part, of course, but first, how'd you sleep last night?
I slept pretty well. I watched some great NFL games, and honestly, I was so exhausted by how exciting that they were that I was ready to fall asleep for seven consecutive hours, which I suppose, as we're about to talk about, is not a historical norm necessarily.
Yes. So you found a sleep historian who's been writing about this practice for a few decades. It turns out that this kind of sleep pattern, which is a medieval pattern, has been happening all over the world for a long time. Tell us what it is and how long it's been going on.
That's right. So today, most people think about sleep as something you're supposed to get in one big chunk of 6, 7, 8, 9 hours. But for hundreds of years in Europe, according to the historian Roger Eckerge, people slept in two segments. It's thus called segmented sleep. They would fall asleep around nightfall, and then they would wake up in the middle of the night for a bit of an intermission that the French called dormir, for wake sleep. And then after a few hours of working or chatting by the fire, they would go back to sleep for second sleep. And Eckerge found information or found proof of these of the segmented sleep, not only in Europe, but really around the world, which has opened up modern eyes to the fact that before the Industrial Revolution, there was not one sleep, but two. Some people, I think, looking back to pre-industrial Europe, assume, well, if that's how they slept before artificial light, if that's how they slept before the modern workday, well, surely that must be the best way to sleep. But it turns out when you dig a little bit deeper into the story, you realize two things that are really fascinating. Number one, even though pre-industrial Europe seemed to enjoy segmented sleep, we now have some evidence that suggests that hunter-gatherers from around the world actually have slept for hundreds and maybe thousands of years in one phase. Not only that, but there's also been some attempts to try to restore segmented or two or biphasic sleep for modern adults. And they found that people who sleep in two segments don't necessarily sleep better. So what I find so interesting about this is that on the one hand, you have the illumination, so to speak, of this pre-modern history of sleep, segmented sleep. But also you dig deeper and you realize just because that practice is old doesn't necessarily mean that it's better. In fact, any kind, the human body seems so flexible when it comes to sleep that just about any single strategy you have, as long as there is a routine behind it, has the possibility of serving as a restful sleep.
So wait a minute. So it doesn't matter if you're getting all the sleep in 1 7-hour dose or a first sleep and a second sleep divided?
That's exactly what I'm saying, is that based on my reading of the evidence and based on my understanding of history, if you're trying to summarize sort of the total research literature of sleep, sleep itself is very, very flexible depending on what you're trying to get out of it. What's most important is that you set up a routine and stick to it as much as possible.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have 1 minute to read the task.
I'm Marty West, and my guest today is Michael Horn. Michael is co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation, and he's also the co-author of the new book, Choosing College: How to Make Better Learning Decisions Throughout Your Life. In the book, you and Bob Muesta use something called the Jobs to be Done framework to look at the college enrollment process. What is Jobs to be Done?
Yeah, so Jobs to be Done is this theory that was developed by Bob and Clay Christensen at the Harvard Business School. And essentially, if you boil it down, it's basically this old adage that people don't buy quarter-inch drills. They just want the whole, right? And they want the outcome from the experience. The product or sort of what they pull into their lives to help them accomplish that is secondary. But I would say Jobs to be Done goes one step further to asking, what's the context the individual's in? What's the circumstances and the priorities or trade-offs they're going to make? And so essentially, a job to be done is helping understand the outcome that is success for you, given where you are in life.
So you're taking this framework, which, as I understand it, has been used to analyze fast food restaurants and all sorts of aspects of the American economy, and applying it to college. And you find that colleges these days do multiple jobs depending on who they're serving. And it's really only a subset of students who are looking for what I think of as the traditional experience of spending 4 years living on your own, developing your identity through a liberal arts curriculum. That's really just one of the jobs colleges are doing these days. What are some of the others?
Yeah, so that's obviously one, and we call that the help me get into my best school job. Some of the others are help me do what's expected of me. So students who are going because someone else in their lives demanded, and they're not quite sure why they're there, honestly. A third one is help me get away. So students running from something, but not necessarily towards something. And then the fourth one is what we call the help me step it up job. So these are students who are looking around and they're like, something about my life isn't right. This isn't a good thing. And if I don't step it up, it's now or never. I've got to turn my life around, in essence. And then the last job that we found is what we call the lifelong learning job of help me extend myself. So these are students who life's pretty good, but they've always wanted to do more, be more, challenge themselves in some ways. And they basically open up the time and budget to allow them to extend themselves in some way.
How did you and Bob go about gathering these data, identifying these jobs that colleges are doing?
Yeah, so it's a pretty involved process of screening a lot of folks. And then essentially, you can't ask people why they went to college because they'll lie to you, not because they're misleading people, but because they don't know in many cases. And so we essentially recreated the college choosing process for them, creating mini documentaries of roughly, it came out to about 260 stories of students making the college choice. And we start to see what are the factors that actually push and pull them to the experience, and what are the trade-offs that they actually make in the heat of the moment and the language that they wrap around it. Then you do a cluster analysis around those forces to figure out what are the different clusters.
What's most important to come out of this research? Is it really just the value of being clear about what you want out of college and making sure the institution that you're choosing is aligned?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, is that we are so obsessed with which school and how do I get in this country that we've almost made college an end to itself, as opposed to stepping back and ask the larger question, why am I going? Really quick example, if you're running to get away from something, success is getting away. A four-year college with a lot of debt, probably not a wise idea, because you don't even know why you're there. And the moment adversity hits, and it will hit, oftentimes that's when we saw students drop out, because they'd say, why am I here? I already succeeded in getting away from something. So if you can understand your why, you can make a better choice.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
I'm Marty West, and my guest today is Michael Horn. Michael is co-founder of the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation, and he's also the co-author of the new book, Choosing College: How to Make Better Learning Decisions Throughout Your Life. In the book, you and Bob Moesta use something called the Jobs to be Done framework to look at the college enrollment process. What is Jobs to be Done?
Yeah, so Jobs to be Done is this theory that was developed by Bob and Clay Christensen at the Harvard Business School. And essentially, if you boil it down, it's basically this old adage that people don't buy quarter-inch drills. They just want the whole, right? And they want the outcome from the experience. The product or sort of what they pull into their lives to help them accomplish that is secondary. But I would say Jobs to be Done goes one step further to asking, what's the context the individual's in? What's the circumstances and the priorities or trade-offs they're going to make? And so essentially, a job to be done is helping understand the outcome that is success for you, given where you are in life.
So you're taking this framework, which, as I understand it, has been used to analyze fast food restaurants and all sorts of aspects of the American economy, and applying it to college. And you find that colleges these days do multiple jobs depending on who they're serving. And it's really only a subset of students who are looking for what I think of as the traditional experience of spending 4 years living on your own, developing your identity through a liberal arts curriculum. That's really just one of the jobs colleges are doing these days. What are some of the others?
Yeah, so that's obviously one, and we call that the help me get into my best school job. Some of the others are help me do what's expected of me. So students who are going because someone else in their lives demanded, and they're not quite sure why they're there, honestly. A third one is help me get away. So students running from something, but not necessarily towards something. And then the fourth one is what we call the help me step it up job. So these are students who are looking around and they're like, something about my life isn't right. This isn't a good thing. And if I don't step it up, it's now or never. I've got to turn my life around, in essence. And then the last job that we found is what we call the lifelong learning job of help me extend myself. So these are students who life is pretty good, but they've always wanted to do more, be more, challenge themselves in some ways. And they basically open up the time and budget to allow them to extend themselves in some way.
How did you and Bob go about gathering these data, identifying these jobs that colleges are doing?
Yeah, so it's a pretty involved process of screening a lot of folks. And then essentially, you can't ask people why they went to college because they'll lie to you, not because they're misleading people, but because they don't know in many cases. And so we essentially recreated the college choosing process for them, creating mini documentaries of roughly, it came out to about 260 stories of students making the college choice. And we start to see what are the factors that actually push and pull them to the experience, and what are the trade-offs that they actually make in the heat of the moment and the language that they wrap around it. Then you do a cluster analysis around those forces to figure out what are the different clusters.
What's most important to come out of this research? Is it really just the value of being clear about what you want out of college and making sure the institution that you're choosing is aligned?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, is that we are so obsessed with which school and how do I get in this country that we've almost made college an end to itself, as opposed to stepping back and ask the larger question, why am I going? Really quick example, if you're running to get away from something, success is getting away. A four-year college with a lot of debt, probably not a wise idea, because you don't even know why you're there. And the moment adversity hits, and it will hit, oftentimes that's when we saw students drop out, because they'd say, why am I here? I already succeeded in getting away from something. So if you can understand your why, you can make a better choice.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. go on to task 3. You have 1 minute to read the task.
Thank you for listening and joining us today. In this episode, we'll be talking about well-being, which is not as easy as it sounds. The topic is quite challenging to define, even for researchers in the field. What is well-being? Is it happiness? Is it a state of good physical and mental health? What do we need to know to study it? 5 specialists in the field decided to attempt to define well-being, not only to guide fellow researchers teaching it, but also for the general public. The result is that the 5 specialists uncovered 8 major findings from the field of subjective well-being. The first of the findings is that well-being is more than just feeling happy. It's tempting to think of happiness when considering well-being. Although the two are linked, the link is not exclusive. The researchers uncovered that people could experience and evaluate their lives positively in various ways without referring to happiness. Also, context is critical to a sense of well-being. The closer someone is to their ideal, the greater their sense of well-being. Therefore, expectations are essential. The second finding is that we can validly measure well-being. The researchers conclude that although well-being measures are imperfect, they are valid enough to yield consistent and valuable information. Because annual happiness indices seem to rank wealthy countries higher, it's a common belief that wealth and happiness are linked. The researchers discovered that income does influence well-being, but only to a point. At the societal level, wealthier nations can better provide freedom, transparent and non-corrupt services, and relative peace to their citizens, thereby contributing to their well-being. But at the individual level, money helps people obtain the things they need and can help them cope with problems. So while access to money is vital for a sense of well-being, it's about affording food, shelter, and social experiences, not so much flat-screen TVs. Another standout finding for the researchers was that high-quality relationships are essential for well-being. Research showed that perceived social support is associated with subjective well-being in every major world region. Those who report the greatest happiness feel respected by others. However, quality is better than quantity. In terms of well-being, it is more important for a person to have a few close and supportive relationships than it is to have many superficial relationships. A common question within psychology on well-being is whether it is determined by nature or nurture. To what extent do genes influence well-being? The 5th finding is that genes and personality do indeed influence well-being. Recent meta-analyses suggest that each person has a baseline level of well-being and that daily events affect shifts above and below this baseline. However, this does not mean there is a single happiness gene, no matter how attractive the notion may be to the media. The 6th finding is that we have an incredible ability to adapt to circumstances, although it can take time. This impacts self-assessment of well-being. Ask someone about their well-being directly after, say, they have been fired from a job, and their answer will be different to, say, a year later. People generally return to former levels of well-being after adverse events. A critical finding is that while we may all yearn for a sense of well-being, whatever that is, culture and society shape it. There is no global measure of well-being. Cultural norms help define well-being. One finding that the researchers noted is that the closer the fit between a person's personality and their cultural environment, the greater their sense of well-being. The final finding in the researchers' analysis of well-being science is one of the more hoped for, that well-being has multiple benefits. A growing body of evidence shows that subjective well-being benefits physical health.
You have 1 minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Thank you for listening and joining us today. In this episode, we'll be talking about well-being, which is not as easy as it sounds. The topic is quite challenging to define, even for researchers in the field. What is well-being? Is it happiness? Is it a state of good physical and mental health? What do we need to know to study it? Five specialists in the field decided to attempt to define well-being, not only to guide fellow researchers teaching it, but also for the general public. The result is that the five specialists uncovered 8 major findings from the field of subjective well-being. The first of the findings is that well-being is more than just feeling happy. It's tempting to think of happiness when considering well-being. Although the two are linked, the link is not exclusive. The researchers uncovered that people could experience and evaluate their lives positively in various ways without referring to happiness. Also, context is critical to a sense of well-being. The closer someone is to their ideal, the greater their sense of well-being. Therefore, expectations are essential. The second finding is that we can validly measure well-being. The researchers conclude that although well-being measures are imperfect, they are valid enough to yield consistent and valuable information. Because annual happiness indices seem to rank wealthy countries higher, it's a common belief that wealth and happiness are linked. The researchers discovered that income does influence well-being, but only to a point. At the societal level, wealthier nations can better provide freedom, transparent and non-corrupt services, and relative peace to their citizens, thereby contributing to their well-being. But at the individual level, money helps people obtain the things they need and can help them cope with problems. So while access to money is vital for a sense of well-being, it's about affording food, shelter, and social experiences, not so much flat-screen TVs. Another standout finding for the researchers was that high-quality relationships are essential for well-being. Research showed that perceived social support is associated with subjective well-being in every major world region. Those who report the greatest happiness feel respected by others. However, quality is better than quantity. In terms of well-being, it is more important for a person to have a few close and supportive relationships than it is to have many superficial relationships. A common question within psychology on well-being is whether it is determined by nature or nurture. To what extent do genes influence well-being? The fifth finding is that genes and personality do indeed influence well-being. Recent meta-analyses suggest that each person has a baseline level of well-being and that daily events affect shifts above and below this baseline. However, this does not mean there is a single happiness gene, no matter how attractive the notion may be to the media. The sixth finding is that we have an incredible ability to adapt to circumstances, although it can take time. This impacts self-assessment of well-being. Ask someone about their well-being directly after, say, they have been fired from a job, and their answer will be different to, say, a year later. People generally return to former levels of well-being after adverse events. A critical finding is that while we may all yearn for a sense of well-being, whatever that is, culture and society shape it. There is no global measure of well-being. Cultural norms help define well-being. One finding that the researchers noted is that the closer the fit between a person's personality and their cultural environment, the greater their sense of well-being. The final finding in the researchers' analysis of well-being science is one of the more hoped for, that well-being has multiple benefits. A growing body of evidence shows that subjective well-being benefits physical health.
You have 1 minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 3 and the whole listening test.